Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At the far edges of San Francisco's Fort Mason in the Firehouse Pavilion, dancers rappel and bounce off of walls. Using ropes and harnesses, they tell the story of Grace and Delia Are Gone. Taking you with them, the dancers show the pervasive, brutal reality for many women. Choreographer Joe Kreider says Grace and Delia address the all-too-commonplace subject of violence against women, and it takes inspiration from history, both in the form of traditional murder ballads and in the site itself, a former military base. Grace and Delia Are Gone tells the stories of women who were killed by their partners for being pregnant or for simply talking back. Intimate partner violence remains the greatest threat to women's health worldwide, and here in the U.S. In 2013, more than 1,600 women were murdered by men in the U.S. That's according to the Violence Policy Center. 94% of those women were killed by men they knew, and the most common weapon used was a gun. Today, we are joined by Joe Kreider, Artistic Director of Flyaway Productions, an apparatus-based dance company. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary with the premiere of Grace and Delia Are Gone. It's showing at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco, and it runs through October 2nd. I saw it last night. It's beautiful. I hope you can see it. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Joe Kreider works at the intersection of social justice and acrobatic spectacle. Through dance, she engages in physical innovation and the political conflicts we live in. And Joe Kreider joins me in studio. Hi, Joe. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Rose.
We're also joined by Denise Catamano, a licensed psychotherapist and director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco. Denise provides crisis intervention and ongoing support to UCSF survivors of sexual assault and sexual violence. She helps them access campus and community resources like counseling and emergency housing. Denise has devoted the last 20 years of her career to the eradication of interpersonal violence, and she is also a domestic violence survivor. And Denise joins me in studio. Hi, Denise. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Joe, I loved the piece. It's so beautiful, like all of your pieces. You have focused on, well, the last two, on homeless women, which I worked with you on, mm-hmm. and you also focused on women who work in sweatshops overseas who make the clothes that most of us buy. Why this time did you decide to focus on violence against women?
Well, I was approached by Fort Mason to potentially produce something there. And so I was thinking about, the impact of the military on culture. And I, of course, always think through a feminist lens. And so I was trying to connect the dots between militarism and the experience of women. And, the military is steeped in violence. That's its primary language and its primary tool and its primary impact. And it all kind of came together at Fort Mason to think about the continuum between state violence, state-sponsored violence, mass violence, and intimate partner violence.
And it's at the Firehouse Pavilion at Fort Mason. I didn't even know this space existed.
Yeah, the Firehouse is an obscure little building on the eastern edge of the Fort Mason campus. And it actually was never a firehouse. It was actually a power station, but it's called the Firehouse now. And when I approached Patrick Hadjek, who runs the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture, he said, "Oh, you want to be in the pavilion, right?" I said, no, I want to be in the Firehouse. And he said, "But it's so small." And I wanted, because of the content of the piece, for the audience to be very close and to be very intimately involved in the experience of the women who are performing. A lot of times my work is on the side of a building and the dancers are 100 feet off the ground, and so you don't get to see their faces. You don't get to hear the impact of their bodies as they're touching the wall. And I wanted an opportunity for intimacy because of the content of the piece.
And so there are four different pieces. One is outside and then the others are in three rooms. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that. You're right, because I did notice sound. Mm-hmm. One woman had a desk and it felt like she was being beaten up and you could hear her body hitting the desk.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty intense.
Yeah.
In the program, you quote Rebecca Solnit, who wrote Men Explain Things to Me, and she writes about violence against women. And here's her quote. We have far more than 87,000 rapes in this country every year, but each of them is invariably portrayed as an isolated incident. We have dots so close, their splatters melting into a stain, but hardly anyone connects them. End quote. And then you write, Joe, Grace and Delia are gone is my attempt to connect the dots.
Yeah, I find it really frustrating that we continually receive news reporting about violence against women, or, you know, just yesterday, a boy in South Carolina killed his father and went to school, to a school, and killed two more kids. And it's all so isolated in the reporting, and it's really hard to create solutions when you're not looking through a sociopolitical lens at what's happening in our culture with violence.
It's such a good point, because we did a show last week with Robert Greenwald about his new documentary, Making a Killing, and it's about gun violence. And in the film, you learn that every 16 hours, a woman is shot and killed by her boyfriend or husband.
Yeah, having a gun in a domestic violence situation increases the likelihood of a domestic violence homicide by 500%.
Wow.
Yeah.
You saw the performance.
I loved it.
What was your reaction?
I found it very moving. Aesthetically, it was beautiful. And it was also, I liked the discomfort of the subject matter. It was beautiful and very moving.
And you're a domestic violence survivor. You work with women at UCSF, I'm sure, and men. And what was your reaction just seeing this issue portrayed in an art piece that's both pretty intense, at times uncomfortable, and very beautiful?
I really appreciate that. I mean, it's a conversation that we need to have, and it can be difficult to have the conversation. And so when it's presented in that way, you know, as art, I think that we can enjoy it. We can be uncomfortable with it, but it also opens us up to talking about it. And that the only way that we're going to make a difference is if we begin to discuss it. So I like that it's out of the closet, and, you know, in the theater or whatever forum. Mm.
And Wednesday night, it was a packed house.
Yeah, we had a sold out show on a Wednesday night. So that was really satisfying.
Well, which shows that people are very interested in this. I mean, if you're a dance fan, but also clearly interested in the topic. Joe, when you sat down to conceptualize all of this, where did you start? Because these stats are alarming. I mean, when you read these articles, it's somewhat shocking. How did you figure out how to weave it and connect the dots?
Well, I'm a huge fan of folk music, including KALW's Saturday program and Kevin Vance. Oh, that's him.
Kevin on the board.
I have to meet him.
He's a big fan of Kevin Vance.
Anyway, and the music was a gentle way in. The ballad Two Sisters, which is one of the pieces we feature, it's a beautiful ballad. There's a gorgeous rhythm and lilt and an amazing history to the song. And so it felt like a gentle way in to look back in history. And Two Sisters is actually about one sister hurting another sister because they're both interested in Willie, the same man. And Willie gives the younger sister a beaver hat, and the older sister's very upset about that and throws her in the river. And she floats down the river, and then she gets to the miller's property, and she says to the miller, "I'll give you my 5 gold rings if you fish me out of here." And he fishes her out. He takes her rings, and then he throws her back in and kills her. So, you know, he's kind of a jerk, the miller. So anyway, but we weren't interested in just using just murder ballads. So the composers and I looked at the stories of these women. So that was Two Sisters. But then we looked at the story of Grace Brown, who's also a real woman. She was killed in 1906 by her lover, and because she was pregnant and he didn't want to deal with her. And so he took her to Big Moose Lake and he drowned her. And so one of the rooms we portray, we call it Grace's Last Night. And it's the night before she's waiting for her lover to come take her away, and so it's the night before he comes and kills her. And I was interested in both the denial that she lives with and the hope, and how those two things exist simultaneously. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Denise, that that's a very common experience for women in that situation, where you're hopeful that things are going to change, but you also, in order to survive, have to maintain a certain distance from your own reality.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Oftentimes women don't realize the severity, or don't acknowledge the severity of the situation until they have some distance, until they're away from it. And the day-to-day survival involves some degree of denial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going back to this music, I mean, it was beautiful. We'll play a clip during the break. How did you find these murder ballads?
Oh, the beauty of the internet. I mean, as I said, I've been listening to folk music programs for, you know, 30 years since I moved to the Bay Area. And so I have a nice habit of listening to that kind of acoustic American music. We also included the story of Delia Green, who was an African-American teenage girl. She was 14, and she was killed in 1902. And Johnny Cash is probably the most famous person singing Delia's Gone. But it's really told from the point of view of the man who killed her. And I was interested in telling these stories from the point of view of the women. Mm-hmm. And then in the second half of the piece, we switch to a contemporary lens and we're in the present day and the dancers are really playing themselves. And I asked the composers to write an anti-murder ballad. And so we used a quote from Rebecca Solnit. And I think you have it in front of you, Rose. I don't have it memorized. Maybe you can read it.
Sure. We have far more than 87,000.
Oh, no, no. The quote at the back of the
back.
Program.
Oh, okay.
Here
yes,
is that road.
Here is that road, maybe 1,000 miles long, and the woman walking down it isn't at mile one. I don't know how far she has to go, but I know she's not going backward despite it all, and she's not walking alone.
Yeah, what I loved about that quote was that, you know, there are 1,000 miles to go and we are at the beginning and we're not at a state of complete solutions and peace, but we've come such a long way and that's something to really celebrate and to dig into and to figure out what's working, what has worked, what has changed, what is good, and also to frame for all women and young women. I do a lot of teaching of young women especially, like what we still need to do.
Denise, what are your thoughts on that? Because just in the past few months, we've done shows about rape on college campuses, sexual assault from Fox News to UC Berkeley, and so many nonprofits and corporations in between. We did a show about violence against women with the use of guns. I mean, there's so much awareness raising going on, thanks to the survivors mainly, who are now speaking out and joining forces. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that a lot of the gains that we made are a direct result of the work that survivors did, bringing attention to the issues, making demands. I mean, the Violence Against Women Act brings a lot of relief to a lot of different populations, immigrant women, for example. But it was survivors demanding that we do something to, you know, to stop the deaths and the violence. And we've come a long way, and we have a long way to go. I thought that last piece was so moving. I could see that the strength of the women and the determination. And, you know, I think that that's what it takes. And also that they were together on the stage really spoke to me, because it's women suffer domestic violence alone and in silence, but to escape it, you need community. And yeah. And that's what that piece said to me, is that there was community.
You know, in the next hour, we're talking about some of the bills that Governor Jerry Brown signed. And this just came up for me because Frontline did two amazing documentaries about women farm workers who are being raped, and then women janitors
yes.
who are being raped because they work late at night, often on their own. And Jerry Brown signed a law that would require janitors and supervisors to complete sexual harassment training, not until 2019. I don't know why it has to wait that long. But what are your thoughts about these small steps, this sexual harassment training?
Well, I think every step counts. And for women who are vulnerable in the ways that farmworking women and janitors are vulnerable, knowing what your rights are makes a difference. And so the training will train the harassers about, you know, what prohibited behavior is and what their risks are. But I think it also helps women to understand that, you know, it names it. It says it's wrong. And it provides some kind of option. So it feels hopeful. And I think it is baby steps. It's always been baby steps. Mm.
Joe, what are your thoughts? When you immersed yourself in all of the research, how did you feel? I mean, I'm sure you were overwhelmed at times, but then we are seeing these small steps.
Yeah. I mean, I think going back to Title IX in the 70s, that was sort of the beginning of women finding a voice in the legislative realm that has carried out into the cultural realm. But in the research that I did about intimate partner violence, I found two contradictory truths. One is that it can happen to anybody, regardless mm-hmm. of, you know, race, class, gender. And then the other thing is true is that domestic violence is concentrated in areas of poverty. So it was a challenge to hold both of those truths as we moved forward with the piece. And, you know, that was a bit of a learning curve for me. It's like, you know, domestic violence has the face of anybody, but it also is, you know, more common in places where there's severe financial stress. And so I wanted to try to illuminate both of those truths.
Joe Kreider is the artistic director of Flyaway Productions, an apparatus-based dance company. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary with the premiere of Grace and Delia Are Gone. It's a beautiful dance performance about violence against women. It's showing at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture, and it is in a building that you may have not heard of before. It's in the Firehouse Pavilion. You have to kind of go in and then far to the left. It's right by the water. And it runs through October 2nd. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. It's tonight through Sunday night.
Yes.
Thursday,
four
Friday.
More shows.
Yeah. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Denise Caramagno, a licensed psychotherapist and director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco. Denise provides crisis intervention and support to survivors of sexual assault and sexual violence. She's devoted 20 years of her career to this issue and is a domestic violence survivor. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on all of the attention that these issues are getting right now and the steps that are being taken to deal with them and prevent these situations from happening? 866-798-8255. If you're a survivor and you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. If you work for an organization that works on these issues, I mean, it's getting so much attention, especially at the college level. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Joe, let's talk about the choreography. Because, again, when you see Grace and Delia Are Gone, you're taken into different sections of the pavilion. One's outside, and then you're in three different rooms. And you know, every time I see your pieces, I just wonder, when you sit down in the beginning, where do you start? Because the strength of these women is just, it's remarkable.
Well, generally, I'm not really sitting ever. That's one thing. But for me, the choreographic process is very collaborative. I work very much with the language and personality of each dancer that I work with. And I think one of the successes of this show is that each dancer has made a very significant contribution to the piece kinetically and visually and energetically. And that's been a really exciting process to be in. I have one dancer, Megan Lowe, who's our youngest dancer. She's 27, and she's got an incredibly elastic and buoyant physicality. And I knew that I wanted her to be the person who got out of the house, so to speak. So we built a set of domestic stairs, and her solo is really about getting out of the house. And she was the perfect collaborator to bring that vision to life. I have another dancer, Yayoi Kambara, who is a former ODC dancer, though she danced with me before she danced with ODC. And I really wanted her to open the second half because I wanted to make that statement about militarization and resisting violence. And Yayoi is a Japanese woman. And, you know, so she looks Asian. And I grew up in the Vietnam War. I was born in 1965. And so when I watch Yayoi, I see, you know, that resistance of Vietnamese women, Asian women resisting American militarization in their countries where we should never have been. Mm-hmm. And that was an important statement to make. So it was really fun to collaborate with the dancers. I give them imagery. I give them certain physical instructions, and then they take it away and they give me back raw material, and then we refine it together. And that's pretty much how it goes. A lot of the vocabulary is mine and a lot of it is not. I feel like I have a very specific aesthetic, and I'm pretty strict about how I want things to look, but I'm also really open. Also, Laura Ellis, who plays the ghost of Delia, and Delia comes back to life to catch Grace as Grace is being drowned. So Delia, in my piece, Delia and Grace meet each other. And the music created for that section was extremely rhythmic. And Laura is an African-American woman and has a deep, long history of studying dance from the African diaspora. Mm. So she's extremely rhythmic in how she approaches motion. And it was a great collaboration for her to offer up all these incredible rhythmic expressions in her body as she was being this ghost coming back.
Wow. How much time does it take to put these pieces together? Because, again, there's four. And, I mean, there's just spinning and jumping and flying. I mean, and you have props also.
Mm-hmm. Well, the piece was conceptualized 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and the process took 2 years.
Wow.
But the actual rehearsal process with the dancers was 7 weeks full time.
Full time. Mm-hmm. It just there's so much that goes into this, right? I mean, we go for an hour and a half, we watch it, and we're very affected by it. But just so much goes into it behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up this set, because Sean Riley is a long-term collaborator of mine, and he designed the set with me. And I was extremely clear about the first half and what the props would be. Like, I knew I wanted to look at Grace's Last Night and that, you know, strange, painful ambivalence that she felt about her lover coming the next day. But for the second half, I knew I wanted to represent the domestic, and I knew I wanted a stairway, but otherwise I was really struggling with what. And Riley said to me, well, what about the frying pan? Mm-hmm. And we made reference to Bugs Bunny, you know, like Bugs Bunny gets smacked by the frying pan. And I'm like, that's actually it. Mm-hmm. That's perfect. And so we came up with these tools of the kitchen, and Riley designed an oversized whisk. Most people think it's real, but it's actually his design. He's using wire rope instead of the whisk wire that's very small and tiny. And we've had so many interesting interpretations of that section of the piece.
I'm sure, because the first thing I thought was the kitchen. So much abuse mm-hmm. happens in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, if you want to see Grace and Delia Argon, and I hope you can, it is showing at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in the Firehouse Pavilion. It's in San Francisco. It's every night through October 2nd. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We talk about violence against women. One question that came up on our last show is, how do we change the culture to truly address this problem? So if you'd like to weigh in on that, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to a caller before break. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. Do we have Bill?
Yes.
Hi, Bill.
I really appreciate what Joe has been doing with her cast and her collaborators. I know women who had been abused, and both a girlfriend and just very dear friends, and connecting the militarization. One, we have a violent society, and two, now we have soldiers who are going for 4 and 5 and 6 tours. This is almost unheard of. Mm-hmm. And then they come back sometimes to situations where they're first responders, either police or fire. And we have to look at how destructive the violence is, both on the intimate level and also just violence against strangers. But we don't want to talk a whole lot in this country about violence between, if not intimates, certainly people who know each other. You know, the idea that there is a place. One of the women that I know had a gun pointed to her, and she said, "You know, I'm going to walk out the door. You're going to do what you're going to do." And luckily, she's still with us. And we just have to. I mean, it's about schooling everyone, not just the boys, not just the girls, but adults too.
Well, thank you for calling, Bill. A quick response, Denise.
Yeah, I agree completely. We have to have these conversations. We have to look at violence throughout our culture and how that affects all of us, and I think we do have to start young, though. You know, we have to talk to children. We have these really strict gender roles that we traditionally have adhered to, and as long as we keep children in those boxes, we will have intimate partner violence.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Thank you for that phone call. Today, we are talking about a new dance performance, Grace and Delia Are Gone, from Flyaway Productions. It's an apparatus-based dance company. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary. You can see Grace and Delia Are Gone at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco. It's in the Firehouse Pavilion. It sold out last night on a Wednesday night, so you might want to get your tickets as we go into the weekend. It's running through October 2nd. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Joe Kreider is artistic director of Flyaway Productions, and Denise Catamano is a licensed psychotherapist and director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Music from the production. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea or experience you'd like to contribute to today's conversation, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. 11 o'clock this morning, we'll be talking about various propositions and bills on the desk of Governor Brown. 11 o'clock tomorrow on KLW, it'll be Inflection Point. Stay tuned.
And that is music from Grace and Delia Are Gone, a new dance performance that focuses on violence against women from Flyaway Productions. It's running through October 2nd at the Fort Mason Center in the Firehouse Pavilion in San Francisco. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Joe Kreider is the artistic director of Flyaway Productions. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary. And Denise Catamano is a licensed psychotherapist, director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco. They provide crisis intervention and support to UCSF survivors of sexual assault and violence. Denise is a domestic violence survivor, and she's devoted 20 years of her career to the eradication of violence. Denise, I understand that you got this job last year?
Yeah, I was hired in 2015. My job comes as a direct result of student demands for changes on campus.
Wow. Okay, so there's another major change.
I think we've seen a sea shift change. I mean, the military had a task force and began to address these issues. We had the White House task force on sexual assaults on college campuses. And the University of San Francisco, Janet Napolitano, had her own task force. So, yeah, we've seen a big change. And it comes as a direct result of student and survivor demands that we begin to address these issues in a meaningful way.
And The Hunting Ground was a great documentary that looked at what happens on college campuses. And then they interviewed so many young women who got together from different colleges across the country on Skype on a regular basis.
Right.
To join forces and file a lawsuit against many universities.
Right, after the universities failed them. I mean, everyone has a right to their education free of sexual harassment and sexual violence, and we're guaranteed that right by federal law. And those universities failed those women. But instead of sitting back and accepting that loss, they got together and they created a sea change. I mean, we all benefit from their efforts.
It's amazing. Recently I saw that some women are burning their college sweatshirts and college sweatpants, basically saying, until you say you're sorry, we are going to burn our outfits to let people know that you haven't taken any, you haven't taken measures like UCSF, for example. So tell us about this CARE program.
So my program, I'm charged with education, prevention, and direct services to survivors of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and gender-based violence. And I work with students, faculty, staff, and postdocs. So with our whole UCSF community, because as Joe said, it touches everyone. And when I came, they told me we probably don't have a lot of work for you. You know, we don't see that many of these cases, and of course, there's a lot of work because.
Wow, that's what I was going to ask you next. So you're actually busy.
Oh yeah, I'm busy, and I do work with everyone, and my services are free and they're confidential. So many of the women I work with, they're not choosing to report what happened to them, but they're seeking support.
Now, do other schools have something like this? Because it sounds like it's relatively new.
All the UCs do now.
Okay.
We each have a care office. Yeah, and so I have there's someone on each of the campuses, and most of the schools do. I mean, there's the acknowledgement that yes, this happens in elite institutions, and it happens in any institution. So there are services where there weren't before, and there's also an effort towards prevention and education that we haven't seen before. So I see every new student at orientation, and I talk about these issues. I talk about the myths and the cultural things that sustain an environment where this can happen. I talk about resources, and I talk about trauma-informed care because our students are going to be clinicians.
And how, I'm sure it differs, obviously, at every college across the country, but I was wondering, as kids go to school and take part in their orientation, how much time is actually spent on the issue of sexual assault and rape?
Right. I would say that it does differ from campus to campus, but more now than ever. I mean, many of the schools have peer education programs. There's a big push to talking about this and talking about it early on. Young women are most at risk of sexual assault during their first 6 weeks on campus. So we have to get to people right away, let them know what the dangers are, what the resources are, and to let them know that we're there, that we're going to address these issues, and that our mandate is to keep them safe.
Hmm. Well, if you'd like to talk about what's done at your school or nonprofit or company, how are you dealing with these issues? And if you have any stories to share about violence against women and what needs to change, not only with policy but also culture, we'd love to hear from you. And then using art to raise awareness about the issue of violence against women, 866-798-8255. Intimate partner violence remains the greatest threat to women's health around the globe, and that includes the United States. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Denise Catamano is a psychotherapist and director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco, and Joe Kreider is the artistic director of Flyaway Productions. Their latest production is Grace and Delia Are Gone, which is about violence against women. It's showing at the Fort Mason Center in San Francisco, and you can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Joe, since this piece debuted, because you tackle so many issues on homelessness, you meet so many people within the community in the Bay Area who are working on this issue. What's been your experience so far focusing on violence against women?
Well, this piece is a little bit different for us because often we're performing site-specific out in the community where we're right there with a lot of different kind of people. And this is Fort Mason is a little bit geographically isolated, and so people have to work to come to us. Mm-hmm. And it's a small house. We can only hold 70 people because I, of course, decided to make a dance in a room that's like 10 by 10. So we have a small audience, and I'm so in the middle that I don't really have an answer for you yet about the impact. But what I do know is that when I dreamed up this project, I applied to the NEA, who has funded us many times, and they actually turned this project down.
Hmm.
And one of the reasons they said is that in my proposal, I did not pitch to go to a shelter and do research with women. And my response to them, you know, to the program exec of the NEA over the phone, was to say, well, first of all, the research is historic. And second of all, we are in many ways a random group of 8 women, the 7 dancers and I. And within the room, we are survivors of intimate partner violence, family violence, and sexual assault. So we didn't need to go very far away to find the impact of violence on our lives. And I think that that's what is important to me, is that this is an every woman's issue, and it's also an everybody's issue. And I'm really interested, like the caller Bill said, in this connection between mass violence and domestic violence, because like the normalization of guns is horrifying to me, and it has to change. And you know, the killings in Orlando were one of the first times that mainstream media started talking about the connection between domestic violence and mass violence. And I think that continuum is really deep and really real and connects back to military training and how that hangs on to a body. So that's where I'm coming from with the project. And I've definitely gotten resonance from people, from individual women who've seen the project.
And again, according to the documentary Making a Killing, every 16 hours a woman is shot and killed by her husband or boyfriend. We're not even talking about the women who survived, because last week we had on Kate Ranta, and her ex-husband shot her and her father. Both of them lived, luckily, but she told her terrifying story. Her husband was in the armed services and had a lot of guns. And their marriage and everything was great for a while, and then all of a sudden he just flipped and turned. And she tells her story in the documentary. So that's just one of many. But talk a little bit more, Joe, about the importance of connecting the dots, because I feel like so many of us are overwhelmed. I mean, you cannot keep up with the shootings and then the young black men who are being shot. Mm-hmm. Over the last week, there have been several, and it's hard to keep up with all of this.
Yeah, I agree. If you read the news, you can get paralyzed. And I think what keeps me going is the ways that the artist community in San Francisco is also an activist community, and the level of compassion and fight in the arts community. So many different artists working on so many different fronts. That's really what keeps me inspired to keep participating in the world. I don't know what to say about that connection, except that it needs to be named. And I feel like there are forces that create isolation in the reporting, as Rebecca Solnit said. You know, oh, this woman was raped. Oh, this jogger was killed for going out jogging. Mm. And interestingly, you know, about 5 weeks ago, there were three women who were killed out jogging. And it was during the moment when we were making the running section of the piece. And I'm like,
wow,
what a horrible irony that I'm trying to represent running as resistance. And at that moment, these three women are killed by strangers, I believe. So that's the dot connecting. I think it's in the naming. And I really do believe in political activism as a really powerful tool for social change. I think that's how we advance. And on every front, there's ways to go. And there's also great progress. And I think to celebrate and simultaneously push is the way to go.
And I'm so glad you brought up the joggers, because that was a month ago. And so a lot of people have moved on. But I just want to read this intro from The Inquisitor. It says, before Vanessa Marcotte was killed jogging in Princeton, Massachusetts, and before Katrina Vitranro was murdered while jogging in Queens, New York, there was Ali Brueger, who was shot in the back while jogging in Rose Township, Michigan. Many people are now opting to run in groups, whereas before they put in their earbuds and headed for their favorite nature trail.
Right. So incredible limitation on your freedom to go out and do a kind of exercise that's free. You don't need a gym membership. You don't need to pay money. You use your own 2 feet. And, you know, so there's a egalitarianism in going out running. And then your freedom is inhibited. And that's not okay with me.
Go ahead, Denise.
I was going to say, historically, that violence is used to control women, and it, you know, it does narrow our lives and impinge on our freedom.
How did you use the stories about the joggers in the piece Grace and Delia Are Gone?
Well, you might remember there was one section where the dancers were running around the audience. They would run, and then they would stop and look at you. And
wow.
Then they keep running. And to me, running was a kind of resistance. I mean, you run out of the house, as Bill just said on the radio. And it's a form of resistance, like being in motion, going away from the problem. Mm. Hopefully you have something to run toward. And that's where people like Denise really come in. And, you know, to catch someone in need is really crucial. And also to have people at the policy level to create the catch that's actually legislated, and then to create the judges who are going to enforce the legislation. So, yeah.
Joe Kreider is the artistic director of Flyaway Productions, an apparatus-based dance company celebrating their 20th anniversary with the premiere of Grace and Delia Are Gone, a dance performance about violence against women. You will see seven dancers rappelling, jumping, spinning off of walls at the Fort Mason Center for the Arts. It's in the Firehouse Pavilion. It's a beautiful performance showing tonight through October 2nd. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Denise Catamano, a psychotherapist, director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco, and a domestic violence survivor. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any stories to share, if you'd like to talk about how we need to deal with these issues, they're getting a lot more attention. We're seeing small steps. What other changes would you like to see? And then what about cultural shifts, which is so important? The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Rodessa in San Francisco. I'm guessing this is Rodessa Jones?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Rodessa.
Hi, I'm just so thrilled. Bravo, bravo. I'm going to try to get out to see the work, and I love the idea that it's in a very small space because it's in people's face.
Yes, very much.
It's in the faces of the public where, as women who are subject to this, we keep it private. Mm. And because I work with incarcerated women, I'm constantly coming in contact with women who can tell the story again and again about the abuse, about the kidnapping, about the rapes that have just gone on in their lives. And my social worker mentor, Sean, used to say to the group, is this okay with you? It's not okay, you know. It's not okay to be beat down. It's not okay to be treated like a doormat, and to have women be amazed, the expressions on their faces that, oh, is that okay? Mm. You know, that this isn't how he loves me. And I was just so thrilled listening to you all talk today that I just had to chime in and just say, it's so important. We're working on a piece, the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. We're working on a piece about domestic violence, and mm. one of the things that I am doing right now is seeking dancers and healers who can come in and help women with movement that speaks to healing, healing from the trauma of being just abused always, you know. And so I just say bravo, and I'm going to try to get out there to see it. And just one other story, when I was working in South Africa, because I work in South Africa, I had this one woman in my group who, one prisoner, and I dropped a phrase. The phrase was, love don't love nobody. Mm. And she took it and wrote, and she came back with this story about how she, her husband had left, and she was living in a junkyard with her children, and she meets this man who says he loves her and he will feed her children. She said, and at first it was okay, and then it got to be he would come home and just, like, go crazy and beat her and rape her in front of her children who were eating the food in the kitchen. And she said, one night I ran to the bedroom, and I got the loaded pistol that he always kept under his pillow. And I'm like, oh, my God, she said. And I threw the pistol at him, and it went off, and a bullet hit him, and he died 2 days later. And that's why I'm in prison. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing because the therapists in the prison in Johannesburg were just amazed that I had found the story through an artistic process. So I can carry on, ladies. I'll be out there. I'm going to come and see it, and bless you all. Bless you.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Rodessa. That's Rodessa Jones, founder of the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, one of my favorite guests on this show. I hope you can go see it, Rodessa, again. It plays through October, shows through October 2nd at the Fort Mason Center in the Firehouse Pavilion. Find information at Your Call Radio. Thank you for calling. I'm so glad, Rodessa, that you brought up trauma and healing.
Yeah.
It makes me realize, Denise, that we're so focused on the stats. We talk about what's happening, what are the programs. We don't spend much time talking about the trauma and the healing process.
Yeah, and Rodessa spoke to that. So much of the trauma that we carry, it's in our body. You know, it's in our DNA. It's in our history. I think a lot of the women who are incarcerated are there as a result of trauma. And what healing looks like is coming back into your body, to feeling your pain and working through it. And also to regaining a sense of autonomy and control. What happens with trauma is that we lose our feeling of power over our own lives. And so part of healing is to, again, feel like we have the control and the power and we can make choices about our own lives. And art is so healing. You know, as a survivor, I felt so empowered by that performance. I felt, you know, I felt saddened. I felt the pain. I felt that, you know, the fear during one of the acts. But I walked out of there feeling hopeful and strong and empowered because that was the message.
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. Thanks, Denise. One of the things you and I talked about before we went on air was shame and how, you know, transforming shame into a voice, into having a voice, is really important. And if we can do that with this show for one person, then I feel like we've done something.
Then you've connected the dots. Yeah, because historically we talk about domestic violence as an isolated personal issue. You know, it happens in the home and it's that person's problem. But now that we've stepped back and acknowledged that this is a social problem, that it's connected to all these other social problems, that, you know, violence runs through our society in so many ways and connects in so many different ways. And you've connected the dots. I hope that women won't suffer in silence, that they will realize that you're not alone, that many women have gone through this, and that we're here, you know, on the other side to support you if you make the choice to seek help.
There was a special report in the Post and Courier called Till Death Do Us Part, and it looked at what happened in South Carolina over the past decade. More than 300 women have been shot, stabbed, strangled, beaten, or burned to death by men in South Carolina over the past decade, dying at a rate of one every 12 days, while the state does little to stem the carnage from domestic abuse. According to this piece, the state's awash in guns, saddled with ineffective laws, lacking enough shelters. They only have 18 domestic violence shelters in South Carolina.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of chance for escape. I also wonder how well the criminal laws are enforced. I mean, likely domestic violence is a felony there if it causes injury. But what happens when the police come out, you know, and what happens if the perpetrator gets arrested? Is it taken seriously? I think a lot of the obstacles towards escape are economic, though, in many mm-hmm. cases. And mm-hmm. so a shelter is a quick fix. But, you know, a real option for housing is a long-term solution.
And then when you look at women of color, the rate of violent crime experienced by American Indian women is 50% higher than every other race.
Right.
50%.
Any status that anything that increases your vulnerability in one way or another increases your vulnerability to domestic violence. And Native women, now under the new VAWA Act, there are some increased protections for Native women, and there's the opportunity for Native courts to prosecute non-Native men who commit crimes on Indian land against Native women. But previously, they didn't have that power. And so non-Indian men would come on the land and take advantage of the fact that they could do what they wanted to almost with impunity.
Mm. Well, we have time for a few more callers. Let's hear from Marianne in San Francisco. Hi, Marianne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really, like, moved following your conversation because as a mother and as a woman, of course, this is a super important issue. But one of the things I'm really observing curiously with my son is, like, he's, like, between the age of 12 and 13, and he's just starting to create relationships with women. And I'm realizing that there's a lot of emphasis on trying to protect girls at this age, but there's very little education or support of, like, helping young boys, like, just to understand correctly how do you deal with girls, how do you deal with women, you know? So I really, the only education they're getting right now is really from, you know, from music, and oftentimes it's very violent, or from peers, you know, or, you know, a simple, like, the internet, where the references they're getting from are not okay, you know? So they're getting self-educated in a way which I really dislike, and I really think, like, it sets them up in a way which is not good, you know, and then we're seeing the outcomes when they come to university, and there's sort of a trail which goes back all the way when they're really young of, like, how they get exposed to relationships.
It's
and sexuality and those things.
Such an important question, Marianne. Jo, you have personal experience with this?
Yeah, I have a 12-year-old boy, and it was a very ironic moment when my son was born and was a son, because I've done feminist work with girls and women my whole life. But it's been wonderful to raise a boy and to really walk the talk that feminism is not just a women's issue. And I think that's the starting point, that you know, treating women well is a basic fact of life that one needs to learn from you know, age two. And you know, my son is the same age as your son. So as he's coming into a new relationship with girls, it's really important for him to appreciate what his mom does, and he does. And there was a funny little comment in my home. We were reading something, and there was some kind of comment about women needing to be seen respectfully, and my son said to my husband, "Oh, I bet Mama believes that." So I think there is a crucial education of boys that needs to happen, and I run a girls' program. And I look forward to the equivalent boys program run by men, perhaps, who are really interested in teaching boys how to be a good man and not what is traditionally thought of as, you know, a macho man.
Mm. Right. Yeah, we need our male allies. I'm also raising a son who I can proudly say identifies as feminist, my son's 17. And I think one of the messages that we have to give boys is that it's okay to be vulnerable and, you know, it's okay to feel your feelings. And there are more options than just anger when it comes to feelings. So we've stunted boys in a way and with the expectation that they're not going to be vulnerable or cry or express any of these other, you know, the range of human emotions. And so we have to open things up for them too.
And Marianne, I think this is a great show idea. I'm going to write this down and bring it to our next editorial meeting. Just quickly, Joe, I noticed half the audience was male last night, which mm-hmm. is fantastic. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from men who see this piece? What do you want men to walk away with?
Well, I'm going to tell the story of my soon-to-be nephew-in-law. My niece is engaged to a man named Dan who lives in New York. And when Dan was in college, he founded a chapter of Men Against Rape. And now he's 30 years old. He works in public health. And he is a volunteer at the hospitals. He gets called in for crisis because the hospitals don't have enough resources for this. So they have a whole volunteer corps of people, and Dan is one of them, who get called in to support rape victims and victims of domestic violence.
Wow.
Not always women. Sometimes it's elderly people of multiple genders. When people ask me this, I say, be like Dan. You know, take it on. Don't shy away from the work that men need to do to be a part of the solution.
Huge respect to Dan.
Yeah.
We just got this great email from Ken who said, in San Leandro, they're getting ready to make a big statement about the safety of women by installing a public sculpture next to the BART station. Truth and beauty poses a timely, compelling question. What would the world be like if women were safe?
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Thank you, Ken.
And then another quote from a project we did this summer. One of my art partners, Celine Parker, did a project with a group of teenage girls, and they did a theater piece, and the last line of the piece was, "My body is not an invitation."
Mm. Joe Kreider is the artistic director of Flyaway Productions. Grace and Delia Are Gone is showing at the Fort Mason Center through October 2nd. Ticket information is at yourcallradio.org. Denise Catamano is a psychotherapist and director of the CARE program at UC San Francisco. Denise and Joe, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the deadly airstrikes on Aleppo, Syria, and the worsening humanitarian situation in the besieged city. We'll also talk about Wells Fargo's account scandal and the allegations that it forced employees to open millions of accounts without customers' permission to reach their sales targets. Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, analysis of the first presidential debate with Senator Bernie Sanders and conservative commentator Ann Coulter after Sandy Newton talks about her latest show, Westworld, and singer Ellis Hall on his career and his latest symphony. It's called Soul Unlimited. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tomorrow at 12 noon here on KALW San Francisco.
Bina features remarkable artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. On today's Bina, StoryCorps founder Dave Isay shares unforgettable stories of people pursuing the work they were born to do. Hear Dave Isay on Bina. Today at noon, here on 91.7 FM, KALW.
Last week, you should have received your California voter guide, and it's massive, 224 pages. The total cost for printing and mailing is close to $15 million. On today's special election edition of Your Call, we're discussing some of the 17 propositions you'll find in that guide. They'll affect the death penalty, plastic bags, the cost of cigarettes, and so many other important issues. And then later in the show, we'll talk about some of the bills that Governor Jerry Brown has signed and vetoed. Very important legislation. Join us after the news.